Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very pleased to have back here on the program once again, May Barenbaum. She is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects. And occasionally she's here on the program. Particularly, we have her here when it's warm, when it's summer, and insects are at their most active, and we talk about insects. Now, usually, I guess we probably wouldn't be seeing her this time of the year. It wouldn't be until next year when she would come by to talk about the Insect Fear Film Festival. But we thought it would be nice to have her back on the program, in part to promote an upcoming show that's going to air on our TV station and a lot of others, a PBS program. That program is Nature, and they will have their season premiere next Sunday, and it's their 26th season, amazingly enough. It's been going all these years. And they'll be talking about the problem of honeybees and colony collapse disorder, which we have talked a little bit about with May. And there has certainly have been a number of articles in the media about that. So this is Nature Silence of the Bees on Sunday, October 28th. On our station, WILL-TV, and wherever you're listening from, you check your local station. And May is in the program, so we'll talk a little bit about this and what right now scientists who study bees think they know about colony collapse disorder. We can talk about that, and we can do what we usually do when she is here, and that is to give people the opportunity to ask questions about insects. Now, we always say when she's here, save your extermination questions. We got a guy for that, Phil Nixon. He comes by and does that, although he loves bugs, too. We all love the bugs. But when May's here, we say, well, the idea is here, you know, you can indulge your curiosity about insects because they are truly fascinating and greatly varied. And so if there's some particular insect that you've seen, you have a question about, if you can describe it as best you can, then she perhaps can give you an identification and we'll go from there. So it's the thing that we usually do when she is here. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Maybe now people, Brett, there may be some people who have not heard some of our previous conversations and they've not heard or read some of the coverage about this. So perhaps we'll just start from the beginning and give us the basics on colony collapse disorder.
Well, about a year ago, this time of year, beekeepers who bring their colonies down to Florida to spend the winter, just like a lot of retirees do, although bees are not, they're still busy, but they just go down to Florida to, because in the northern states, winters are very tough on bees because of the cold temperatures. Number of beekeepers, one in particular from Pennsylvania, went to check on his bees that he'd moved to Florida and was horrified to find almost all of them gone. Typically, a beehive, a working beehive, has between 30 to 50,000 workers. These are individuals that take care of all the jobs of the colony, about 200 to 300 drones and one queen. And the queen lays eggs in the among the jobs of the workers to take care of the grubs, the offspring. Well, this colony structure was completely gone in the colonies that the Pennsylvania beekeeper had moved to Florida. What was left was there were just a handful of very young bees. Bees work through different tasks in the hive as they age. It's called age-related polyethism. So the very youngest adult bees take care of the hive duties, like cleaning the cells and feeding the brood. And it's only the very oldest, most experienced bees that go out to forage. Well, these colonies had no foragers. They had only very young bees who could not handle all the tasks responsible for in the colony. And often colonies will experience large losses of foragers, but usually it's because of some mortality agent like a pesticide, and you see the dead bees all around the colony. Well, these bees were just gone. They were vanished. And that was very creepy and strange and inexplicable. And then the reports began to multiply, and more and more beekeepers, not just in Florida, but throughout the U.S., were finding their bees gone. Moreover, it was clear that this was not like other disappearances in the past, in that these collapsed colonies seemed to be repellent to other insects. A beehive is absolutely chock full of carbohydrates and protein for anyone who can get past the defenders. So when the colonies collapse, there are no bees to sting anybody. And normally there's a whole suite of pests of beehives, like small hive beetle, wax moth, even other bees will come in and rob the honey. Nothing went near these colonies, which suggested something awful had happened in there. And so the reports kept coming in. By February, there were about there were reports of almost, two dozen states, and there was a sort of a confab in Florida, sort of the ground zero, I guess, of colony collapse disorder. A number of investigators were brought in, and beekeepers, and an attempt, an organized approach to trying to figure out what was going on got underway. And to make a long story short, the numbers of disappearances increased. There were some 35 states ultimately by June that had collapses. And this is important, not if you like honey in your toast and tea, but because bees are the premier managed pollinator for U.S. agriculture. About $14 billion worth of U.S. agriculture depends on the pollination services of honeybees. In particular, the problem was quite acute in February and March when it came to everyone's attention, because half of America's bees, half of America has about 2.4 million colonies of bees. Half of them go every spring to almond orchards to pollinate almonds. Almonds are a $2.5 billion industry that depends entirely on bees. There's honeybees. Nothing else really pollinates them effectively. So the almond growers were up in arms about this, because they actually pay for rental, to rent honeybee colonies. And rental fees a few years ago were in the $10, $20, $30 range. This past year, they were in the $130, $140 range. So they'd increased tenfold because the supply was limited. So, of course, we have two states that are very important in agriculture, Florida and California, that were hard hit by this. And we have – and the U.S. the Senate and both House and Senate Ag Committees have representatives from those states, and or at least the House Ag Committee does. So there were hearings. National attention was brought to this situation. There's language now in the Farm Bill about pollinator protection and a new funding initiative to figure out what's going on with this colony collapse disorder. And I guess to bring things up to the present, there are some results finally coming out that implicate a new virus in town. Bees basically live in big cities, just like people do, and they're in constant contact with members of the same species. And not surprisingly, animals that live at high densities are prone to epidemics of various sorts. So what appears to have happened, this is a new virus called Israeli acute paralysis virus, IAPV, first described in Israel in 2004, unknown in this country. A group of collaborators from Columbia University and Penn State used what's called a metagenomics approach. Another thing that happened last year in October 2006 was that the honeybee genome was sequenced. So we now have all kinds of new tools to figure out what's going on with honeybees. So the metagenomics approach allowed these investigators to grind up bees, subtract out all the genetic code that belongs to honeybees, all 11,000 honeybee genes, and see what was left. And what was left was a big stew of viruses and bacteria and fungi and everything else. And the difference in the stew between the collapsing colonies and the healthy colonies was this one IAPV virus. Mm-hmm. But it's not the whole story, because, among other things, in Israel, Israeli acute paralysis virus causes a different suite of symptoms. It leaves dead bees in front of the colony. And so it doesn't explain why the bodies aren't found in the U.S. So it's not the total answer. People believe there's some other factor in particular that's affecting the ability of bees to navigate and orient in their environment. Forager bees are unbelievable. They go out to, it's not an easy living. It's not easy to make your living feeding on nectar, because nectar is not — it's not like grass. It's not always available. It's available for a short period of time for any particular flower. So bees have this incredible ability to communicate with their nest mates. They can find a source of nectar that's only going to be available for a few hours or a couple of days, come back to the nest, do a symbolic dance to communicate directions on how to get there. sort of bee map quest. And the bees, other foragers will go to that site and come back with nectar. And the thought is something is interfering with their ability to communicate and navigate. And that's why the foragers are not coming home. And IAPV doesn't really explain that. And if you read it, listeners can stand one more. I mean, I can go on and on about this. This is life on the B list for me. My year on the B list. And what the other interesting angle is that, okay, how does the virus get here? How do we have, turns out in 2004, for the first time since 1922, Congress allowed the importation of bees from other countries. The Honeybee Act of 1922 was passed to keep our bees safe from foreign diseases, and it worked fairly well. There were mites that got in. There were some other problems that bees had. But in 2004, pressure was so intense from the agriculture sector, particularly the almond industry, that bees were allowed in from Australia and New Zealand. And Ian Lipkin and Diana Cox Foster, who, by the way, is a University of Illinois alum, found that IAPV virus in Australian bees. So the scenario, the presumed scenario, is that when we brought bees in from Australia to supplement our already dwindling supply, we inadvertently introduced this new virus, although the Australians are adamantly denying that they have anything resembling a colony collapse disorder, even if their bees are carrying the virus. It's just been an incredible year because, well, I guess the ultimate expression of how America's consciousness has been raised on this issue is the fact that in the top-rated show on network television, CSI, entomologist Gil Grissom is investigating colony collapse disorder. And he was at a crime scene 2 weeks ago and found a healthy nest and brought it back. And the storyline continued until last week's episode. And he's investigating colony collapse disorder. And some of my colleagues in the colony collapse disorder working group are anxiously awaiting his findings.
He's going to figure it out for me?
Yeah, well, maybe one of my colleagues has suggested maybe that's where all the bees went. They're in Las Vegas, you know.
Well, as you say, I think as I have followed the story and the things that I've read about it, and just as you've explained it, two things here seem to be really significant. One, just for people to keep in mind, one is what happens when you introduce something from one environment into another. You know, you never know how exactly that's going to go, particularly if that's a non-native species. And then the other thing, as you say, that's really interesting is that here it shows you that it looks as if there is some interaction between this virus or some effect on the way that it acts depending on the environment, so that you could have the virus affecting the bees in Israel, for example, and have it look different than when it affects the bees in the United States. And presumably, if it's there in Australia, it's maybe doing something different there too. So the context is a real important determinant into how that virus operates. So that's another really interesting thing too.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a whole suite of researchers looking into those complementary environmental influences. What we've been able to establish is that bees really are, pardon the expression, beset. I mean, there's one project involves quantifying the presence in the hive of synthetic organic chemicals, the thought being that there are pesticides out there that are being used in agricultural fields that bees encounter. And one group of pesticides called the neonicotinoids are relatively new, which would account for the sudden onset of this peculiar phenomenon. Moreover, they target the nervous system. And there are studies that have been done earlier that demonstrate that these compounds have an effect on bee memory and behavior. So one in particular, imidacloprid, is being used on dozens of different crops, and it's systemic, which means the plants take it up and it is contained in the pollen. So that would also account for the appearance of colony collapse later in the season, because bees store pollen for when hard times arrive, and they go to their pollen stores to feed their brood and maintain themselves through the winter. So their exposure to pesticides isn't necessarily acute. It's not like they fly into a field and drop dead, but they bring back contaminated pollen. And the results of some assays of hive materials, including wax, pollen, bee bread, which is pollen mixed with honey, and this was fed to the babies, and other materials in the nest show evidence of over 100 different synthetic chemicals. Because bees just, they fly, they are sampling the environment. Whatever's out there, that's what clings to them and comes back. So that's going to be a little hard to narrow down. We have managed, however, to rule out a number of hypotheses that keep rearing their ugly heads. This has nothing to do with cell phones. The cell phone story was the result of a mistranslation of a very small, unpublished, unrefereed German study on not cell phones, but cordless phones, where they put the base of a cordless phone inside a colony, and it disturbed the bees. Well, that's not very surprising. Imagine if you walked into your house and you found an enormous metal box that took up most of the living room. I mean, these two scientists weren't even aware of colony collapse disorder, and were horrified that this rose to such a level that Dick Cheney's office actually requested a debriefing on the part of the USDA Bee Lab about the cell phone business. And this is not an office that has expressed a whole lot of interest hitherto in honeybees. So I think you can not worry. There may be problems with cell phones, but you're not killing the bees if you're making a phone call. There's no evidence of elevated CO2, elevated UVB, changes in the Earth's magnetic field, Osama bin Laden, automobile grills, mutant bee cannibalism, all kinds of things. Genetically modified crops have also been suggested as a possible cause of the problem. And again, there's no compelling evidence linking colony collapse disorder in its unique suite of symptoms with GM crops. I think the best argument against GM corn pollen in particular and colony collapse disorder is here in Champaign County, 80% of what's of the corn that's planted is genetically modified, and we're free. We are CCD free, and we should be ground zero if that's a problem. Corn pollen is wind pollinated. I mean, corn is a wind pollinated plant. Bees don't like corn pollen, and they'll only take it if they're really, really desperate. And there are a number of studies, laboratory and field studies, that show that while there may be some effects of massive consumption of corn pollen, it's not the same suite of symptoms as colony collapse. I've probably gone on too long here. But
no, I think it's quite fascinating, as a matter of fact. Let me just introduce again our guest, May Barenbaum. She's a professor of entomology here at the U of I. In fact, she's the head of the Department of Entomology. And every once in a while, she's here and we talk about insects. And we're talking specifically here about bees and the problem of colony collapse disorder, because this issue and the effort to investigate and try to understand what's going on will be the subject of the first program this season of the public television series Nature. They're kicking off their 26th season with a program that they're calling Silence of the Bees, which looks at this very thing. And you can see it here on our television station next Sunday, the 28th, 8 o'clock in the evening. I guess, that's Eastern time, so I think that means it will be 7 o'clock here. Consult your local listings or your copy of Patterns if you have it. May appears in the documentary, and you also said you think that Gene Robinson, who is another scientist here at the U of I, who is a specialist in studying bees, he's actually been on the program here, and we've talked a little bit about some of his work. He looks at bee genetics, is that right? And he's particularly interested in this issue of, or this question of, potential relationship between genes and behavior, and whether in fact there could be some bee behaviors that are encoded in their genes. Right?
Yeah, he's actually, I'm not a bee biologist.
He's really his thing is bees.
The way I got into this is that, two ways. One, I was, the National Academy of Sciences did a study, an 18-month study trying to determine what the status is of North American pollinators. And I chaired that study. And the study, interestingly enough, came out in October, the same month that the honeybee genome was published. And Gene was the leader and driving force in getting the genomes sequenced. Mm-hmm. And the same month that the beekeeper with the problems in Florida began to wonder what was going on. So Gene calls it the perfect storm for honeybees, this convergence of unusual circumstances. So I keep telling the University of Illinois when they send out press releases, I am not a noted bee researcher. Ask any bee researcher if I am one of them, and they will say I'm not. But yeah. The way I got interested was through, I got involved was because of this National Academy study. One of our conclusions was that the apiculture industry is not on a firm footing, and moreover, there have been so many other problems with other pollinators that we are overly dependent on this one species.
We have some calls here coming in, and if you'd like to talk with our guest, May Barenbaum, you can give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our first caller is in Arcola on the toll-free line, our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. We have a couple of fountains in our garden areas, and it tends to attract bees, and then they fall in and drown.
Uh-huh.
Is there any way to protect them from that? Or
that's a really it's an interesting point. Bees do need water, and in fact, they're, you know how bees have specialized tasks? There are some bees that are nurses and some bees that are guards. There is a special group of bees in the typical bee colony whose job is to bring water back to the colony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just for drinking, but they use it to air condition their colony because it's evaporative cooling. My guess is I don't know any particular way to keep them safe other than maybe to put objects floating in there that they could possibly grab onto, but the mortality that they experience as a result of drowning in fountains, I think, is very low level compared to other mass enormous causes of mortality, particularly pesticide exposures.
Sure.
So you're actually doing them a wonderful service by providing them a source of nice clean water. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Atlanta, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
How are you guys doing
good
today?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I've got at least two questions on bees. Firstly, has there been studies done regarding not necessarily wild bees, but bees that are putting their honey in trees and stuff like that, that are just kind of running around loose out here in the country that are in hives? And then my second question is, as I understand it, bees are an import themselves, and mm-hmm. at least honeybees are. And are other countries like South America probably might, they might have done the same thing in Europe, are they having the same problem in those countries?
So two questions. I'll do the second first was that bees are not native to North America. That's exactly right. They are the genus Apis, to which the honeybee belongs, depends on who you talk to, between 9 and 12 species, and it's Eurasian. Our honeybee, Apis mellifera, is called the Western honeybee. It's native to Europe, we've had honeybees here as long as we've had European settlers because they discovered they couldn't grow some of their favorite crop plants without them. Not only did they like the honey as a wonderful source of sugar before sugar cane, became a major source of commercial sugar, it was a very important sweetener for the early settlers. But apples, for example, I guess it was the governor of Massachusetts, couldn't have his apple orchard until he brought bees over. So in the 17th century, bees were imported, and they were so well established that some experts by the 18th century thought they were native. The Native Americans knew better. They actually called them white man's flies because everywhere Europeans went, these annoying, pesty new insects appeared, although Native Americans quickly learned how to utilize the wild bees, the ones you referred to in your second question. The technical term is feral because feral means they were once domesticated and they escaped. Although whether bees are truly domesticated animal has been a legal issue going back to Roman times. It's not like your dog where they have a name and you can call them and they'll come to you. And they are managed, but whether they're actually domesticated, because if you leave them on their own, they often can take care of themselves, which cows, for example, would have a hard time doing here. And their tendency to escape has meant for centuries we've had populations of feral bees. Wild bees, they're tree nesters, or cavity nesters. They like to nest in holes and spaces, and they build their comb there. And what you asked was a question that the National Academy Study Committee also asked, is what's going on with feral bees? And it turns out we have essentially no idea. There were some studies in the 1980s on both coasts after the accidental introduction of parasitic mites, and because it was clear to anyone paying any attention that these mites were having an absolutely devastating impact on colonies that were not being managed by humans. Since that time, I know of really only one individual who has been monitoring feral bee populations, and he's in upstate New York. And in response to this, one of the recommendations of our study committee was to get citizen scientists involved in looking for bees. We don't have enough experts in bees to cover the country to find out where the feral bees are and what the status is of other wild, truly wild native species. So here at the University of Illinois, actually, I don't know if this is an appropriate segue here, but we've started a website for citizen scientists called Bee Spotter, and it's restricted only to Illinois, and it's for only the 11 or 12 species of bumblebees, genus Bombus, that live in Illinois, and Apis mellifera. What we're hoping to do is people can sign on to the website and then upload a picture, a photo, and we'll have an interactive user-friendly key for identifying bumblebees, differentiating among the species. You can do a pretty good job of telling one species from the other based on their color pattern. They're yellow and black for the most part, but patterned differently. Honeybees, many people can recognize, although we also have a page on that website on what is and isn't a bee, and at least one of the photos uploaded was a mimetic fly. Flies like to mimic bees because other animals will leave them alone because they're afraid of getting a stung. So we've already had 100 people sign up for the website and post images, and the images are accompanied with the location or GPS coordinates. And what we're doing is importing the digital records from the Illinois Natural History Survey collection. This is the seventh largest insect collection in the U.S. with over 7 million specimens. And we have many historic records going back 100 years or more of bumblebees and honeybees in the state. And what we want to do is map the contemporary sightings onto the historical records and see if our honeybees in Illinois and our bumblebees are experiencing changes in distribution patterns and abundance. So we're hoping to get citizens involved in this project so that it's more than any single entomologist can handle. So thanks for asking the perfect question for the segue.
Well, that was really an exciting answer, actually. And back to the question on other countries.
Oh, other countries, right. Thank you. Yes, that's also been epidemiologically very interesting. I think one reason people are so interested in this is that it is a mystery. There's no bodies. And finding out what killed some, you know, even on CSI, without a body, it's hard to make a case. And at this meeting in April of what became the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group, people were invited from other countries, and discussion arose that maybe American beekeeping practices were the cause of colony collapse. Bees, for example, are loaded up onto flatbed trucks, driven 1,000 to 2,000 miles across the country to pollinate almonds and orchards, then up north to pollinate clover in Montana and alfalfa through the western states. And sometimes overwintering, they're fed high fructose corn syrup, which is the sweetener in Coca-Cola, which isn't great for us. So imagine it's not that wonderful nutritionally for bees. And a Swiss scientist stood up and was adamant in saying it can't be management practices because Swiss bees are also dying in exactly the same way.
Right.
And in fact, in Switzerland, you cannot drive 1,000 miles with bees on a flatbed and still be in Switzerland. So they don't have this migratory beekeeping practice that was being indicted. So all throughout Europe, Spain had collapses. Even France, which had banned the insecticide imidacloprid a few years ago because the beekeepers there suspected it was causing problems in their beekeeping industry. England has had collapses. There are reported problems in Taiwan. So it is by no means isolated to the United States. Canada, for a long time, it wasn't clear, but it's now apparent in Ontario in particular, which is one of the major beekeeping centers for Canada that there have been losses.
Well, this is really getting scary now that you've thrown that little tidbit in there as far as the worldwide problem instead of just our problem. And I really thank you for the answers.
Thank you for asking.
So how many native bee species are there in North America, let's say?
There are about 3,500 species of bees. As it turns out, the U.S. or North America in general is a center for bee diversity. We are rich. The western U.S. is rich in bees. We, for example, have about 11 or 12 bumblebees. Nebraska, just that far west, there's 49 species of bumblebees. So is that right? No, there's 49 species of bumblebees in the U.S., but I think there's 19 in Nebraska. And you keep going further west, there's more bumblebees, there's more digger bees, there's more plasterer bees, mason bees. There's all kinds of other bee families, little tiny solitary bees. And we really have no clue what's going on with native pollinators, none. There's nobody doing any kind of population censuses with the exception of just a few individuals with certain specialties and certain groups. Bumblebees, for example. And one reason we know bumblebees are in trouble is that there have been some very dedicated individuals who have been tracking bumblebees for years. And there are a number of species that are so threatened as to be on the edge of extinction or may even be possibly extinct. We may have lost at least two species of bumblebees from North America. And nobody knows why. And in contrast, in Europe, there have been citizen scientist monitoring projects going on for 20 to 30 years. So there's clear evidence of declines in important pollinator groups from these citizen scientist monitoring efforts, and notably in Britain, but also elsewhere in the EU. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason to suppose it's not happening here, because of what seems to be responsible in Europe is a decline in the diversity of the landscape. Just like here, growers all over the world, farmers pride themselves on clean fields. Clean fields mean no weeds. Well, weeds are also wildflowers that produce nectar and pollen. So between urbanization, which eliminates a lot of resources and habitats, and agriculture, there's been there is an apparent reduction in the availability of resources that are needed for bees to maintain themselves.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects, and occasionally he's here on the program, and we talk about insects. And particularly here, we're talking this morning about bees, in part because she is one of a couple of scientists here from the University of Illinois that appear in a new documentary that will be the season premiere of the PBS program Nature. It's the beginning of their 26th season. The program is Silence of the Bees, and it takes a look at the effort by scientists to try to understand this problem that Mae has been talking about, colony collapse disorder. And the program premieres next Sunday. And you can see it here on WILL-TV, and I'm sure on other public stations, depending on what station you watch. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
I'm feeling very badly because I was vacuuming up carpenter bees this past year. They keep drilling holes in my house, and the only way I could figure out environmentally to keep them from drilling holes in my house was to vacuum them as they were chewing on my house. I got my shop vac out and zapped them. And so I'm wondering if there is some way one can provide homes for carpenter bees without having them chew on your house. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, it's interesting that you ask that. Actually, carpenter bees are important pollinators, and they do tend to like to return to the same places. So that, but what I, you know, if you want to, I mean, there are ways, sort of permanent solutions, as it were, to get rid of carpenter bees. But it's my understanding that you can discourage them from returning to the same place just by treating the wood surface with paint, like an oil-based paint or polyurethane. That reduces their likelihood of attacking that same surface. But if you want to keep the bees around, you can just provide them with an alternative source of, they like sort of older aged wood. So one of the goals of the study was to figure out what measures could be taken for restoration and conservation. And one important part that of conservation of pollinator diversity is providing habitats, because a lot of the habitats bees like to occupy aren't exactly compatible with human interests. So there may be a way to provide alternate weathered wood for them that they would find satisfactory. But in keeping them out of their favorite place, it's been suggested that you just seal the existing entrances to the galleries, and then if you can paint that surface with polyurethane or oil-based paint, that would make them less likely to attack.
Well, I had done that last year.
Okay.
I didn't realize it needed to be polyurethane or oil-based paint, so I should try at least a primer, because in a couple of places they went right through the latex.
Right. I think it's not offensive enough or disgusting enough to keep them out.
Yeah. I should point out to people that the carpenter bumblebees don't seem to be interested in stinging people.
Right.
They kind of bumble into you now.
That's right.
But they don't ever, I've never been stung by one. I've swatted them with tennis rackets and all kinds of things to get them to leave my carport alone. But they've never, ever stung me. And
well, there's two reasons for that. One is the ones you're likely encountering are males, and they don't have a stinger. Males never sting, because the stinger is actually a modified ovipositor or egg-laying device, and of course, guys don't have those. The other reason that they don't sting, and they're way less likely to sting than yellow jackets, paper wasps, or honeybees or bumblebees, is that most stinging is in defense of a colonial nest. And carpenter bees are not colonial. They're not social the same way that honeybees and bumblebees are. The females will excavate a gallery, you know, and she'll make cells in your wood surface and put little balls of pollen and other bee substances in the cells at the end of the gallery, seal them up, and then fly away. So there's no society to defend. They don't need armies. They're not protecting their nest site. In fact, females die pretty soon after they lay their eggs. So the social insects are the ones that defend, that use that stinger for keeping away intruders who present a threat to their babies or their stored provisions.
I noticed a circular hole in one of the boards in our wood compost heap, and noticed a bee marching back and forth across inside the hole in the gallery, and I decided to leave that one alone because it wasn't bothering me, and I, you know, it doesn't make much difference in the compost heap. So will next year somebody come along and see that hole and another bumblebee use that one?
Well, it's probably not a bumblebee. It's probably a carpenter bee.
You mean a carpenter bee?
Yeah.
Well, I call them, they look like bumblebees.
They do, but they're actually in a different genus,
and
they have a very different social structure. They do look a whole lot like it, but the easiest way to distinguish bumblebees from carpenter bees is carpenter bees have a sort of bare butt. Bumblebees have fuzzy butts. So if you want to get close enough to see if there's a hairy butt, then you know it's a bumblebee. They also have bumblebees collect way more pollen because they have all these babies to feed in their nests that have about 300 workers in them. And they have if you look at their back legs, they have a little pollen basket, a little flattened area for big balls of pollen. They do look an awful lot like bumblebees.
So where do bumblebees make their nest?
Bumblebees are also, they like cavities, but they like sort of prefab cavities. And one of their favorite places to nest is in abandoned mouse burrows. So underground nests and galleries that mice and other rodents have already excavated. In fact, it's been suggested that I think Darwin described the connection between spinsters and the strength of the British Navy. And it was because the spinsters kept cats. The cats ate the rodents that abandoned the burrows, which made it all right for bumblebees to flourish, and bumblebees pollinated clover, which was used to grow hay to feed to cattle, which provided beef for the Navy. So kind of complicated, but it just shows how interrelated everything is. So, the British Empire depended in the late 19th century on bumblebees, and they, I guess, in turn depended on spinsters. So.
Thanks a bunch.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left here this morning with May Barenbaum. She's a professor of entomology here at the University of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to something for a second, we had an off-the-air question here, and it may be somebody was not listening a little bit earlier when you were talking about the things that people had questioned as contributors to colony collapse disorder, and then pretty much have been ruled out. And this again goes back to the question of genetically engineered crops that have that produce their own pesticide. You did talk about corn and said that basically the bees really don't, and they're not all that interested in corn pollen. So that seems not to be a problem. And here, because we have lots of BT corn, we don't have colony collapse disorder. So you'd think if that was a problem, we'd be seeing it in Illinois. Are there concerns about bees and some of the other crops? Because there are other crops that do,
absolutely.
Do the same.
In Canada, there's genetically modified canola or rapeseed. It's an oilseed plant. GM soybeans dominate the landscape here. They're not engineered with a pesticide, an insecticidal compound, but they are engineered with an herbicidal compound. So, yes, if they eat soybean pollen, which is not a real popular pollen with bees either, but then there's a possibility for harm in that context as well. The widespread distribution of colony collapse in Europe also undermines the importance of the suggestion that colony collapse disorder is due in large part to GM crops, because planting of GM crops is extremely restricted in Europe. There's very, very little of the landscape is covered with colony collapse. With GM crops. There was a 5-year study, farm study, done on genetically modified herbicide tolerant weeds. It's Roundup Ready beets, actually, and GM corn that was done in England. And there was an association between the abundance of bees and butterflies and the planting of genetically modified beets and corn. And what the association was, as it turns out, is that fields that are planted with GM or herbicide-tolerant beets have fewer weeds, because that's the whole point. You spray the field with herbicide and kill everything but the beets. And as a consequence, bees and butterflies were less abundant because there were fewer resources. There have been laboratory and field studies on all kinds of GM crops that have failed to document the kind of behavioral, physiological, and developmental problems that are associated with colony collapse disorder. There are all kinds of problems using genetically modified crops. I'm not an enormous fan of GM crops, but you can't pin colony collapse disorder on GM crops with the available evidence, and it's not for want of study. There have been a number of studies, and these were reviewed by the study committee. Even before CCD, the questions were raised about the safety of GM crops for bees. And I have to add that GM crops are way safer than the alternative chemical pesticides, which clearly have adverse effects on bees.
Okay. And also, somebody would like just for you to mention again about bee spotter.
Sure thing. My pleasure. I know we kind of launched it at the exactly wrong time of year, because it's getting harder and harder to spot the bees. But, you know, with the unusually warm weather, there's still opportunities. So the site is, give you the URL is http://. BeeSpotter, BeeSpotter dot M as in Mary, S as in Stephen, T-E, Misty is the site that hosts it, dot UIUC.edu. If you didn't get that, all you have to do is, in Google, is write BeeSpotter, and it'll be the first link. And Google will ask you, are you sure you don't mean beef spotter? I don't know who's spotting beef. I know they're looking for Holstein cows or what, but no beef spotter. It's bee spotter. And you can log in, set up an account. We're adding content every day. There will be biographies of all 11 bumblebees, information on how to avoid getting stung. One reason we're doing pictures is usually the way experts identify bees is by catching them, killing them, and dissecting out their genitalia. And this is all about saving the bees, not going sending people out to catch them and dissect them. So because bumblebees are so easily color-coded, it makes it very user-friendly. And there's a user-friendly key. Doesn't have to be a prize-winning photo, just clear enough to see the banding pattern. And you can upload the photo, try to do an ID yourself. We have experts who will check the photos. We have over 100 people who have signed up in the 2 weeks since the site launched. And even a fourth-grade class in Thomas Paine, the kids uploaded 160 images. So every record will go into the database that will let us know where the bees are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, the easiest thing to do is in your web browser, just put in bee spotter as one word. And just what I did here myself, I did the very thing. And the first thing that came up was the bee spotter site. So that'll get you to there. All right. We have maybe about 5 minutes left. We have one more caller here. We certainly want to include in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just finished a Shakespeare class, so to be or not to be. I thought I saw a program in terms of Geno or some other, but these things sometimes don't appear for was shown for three generations. So in other words, something that could be affecting now could go through a few generations and then appear, right?
I guess it depends on the nature of the problem. There have been disappearances in the past, and in fact, there was some concern in the 70s that maybe there was some sort of genetic erosion going on with honeybees which I guess you might, as you suggest, would be sort of successively worse each generation. But colony collapse seemed to have an alarmingly rapid onset, which wouldn't be multiple generations.
But I mean, in terms of pesticides, which is...
Oh, delayed effects of pesticides, certainly.
But I mean, even before, I just wonder whether a residual effect is not going on to a certain degree. I don't know.
Well, we have no compelling data to rule that possibility out. One reason people are suspicious of the imidacloprid and the other neonicotinoids is that their appearance, at least some of the newer forms, their widespread use more or less coincides with this recent suite of problems in the beekeeping industry. So, but yes, there could be very very easily could be long term.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Is that neonicotinoid as in nicotine?
Yeah, it's neo means new. Mm-hmm. Nicotine is a plant-derived product. Of course, it's in tobacco, and it has been used for 400 years as an insecticide. And the way nicotine works on insects, and remember all you would-be smokers out there, that we share the same nervous system quirk, nicotine is an alkaloid, a nitrogen-containing chemical that looks an awful lot like acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is what's called a neurotransmitter substance. It's how nerve cells in our nervous system, the nervous system of most animals, communicate with one another. So to send a nerve signal from one cell to another, acetylcholine is released across the little gap, the cleft between the two cells, and hits the adjacent nerve cell. There's a little receptor there and makes the nerve send out its electrical signal. Well, nicotine fits into the receptor on that receiving end nerve cell and causes the cell to fire, even though it's not supposed to be a nervous signal, which is why when bees or other insects are poisoned by nicotine, they have convulsions and tremors. Their nervous system is going nuts. And if you ingest nicotine, that's what will happen to you too. So it's not a particularly safe insecticide to use, which is why the neonicotinoids were devised. These are have effects on invertebrates and have lesser effects on humans. And they also have some more environmentally compatible features. But they don't have no effects on insects, on non-target insects. And among the non-target insects are bees, whose behavior is sufficiently complex that a little bit of reduced function of, you know, brain and nervous system function can have disastrous consequences.
Well, I think we're about the point where we're going to have to stop. Having now thoroughly discussed the subject, if you'd like to learn more, if you're interested in this search for the explanation to colony collapse disorder, you'll want to be watching for the program Nature. Its 26th season will kick off with the program Silence of the Bees that takes a look at the effort to try to understand this problem. And May appears in there. Also, U of I scientist Gene Robinson is in there, too, and a lot of other scientists, I'm sure. And you can see this program on our station, WILL-TV, next Sunday, the 28th, at 7 in the evening. And I'm sure whatever public television station you watch, you can check up on the program. And probably now we won't see you until time
February,
for the festival.
The 25th Insect
Festival. Right. Do you know what the theme of the festival will be?
Actually, I'm not sure at this point. It will either be an all Illini Insect Fear Film Festival, where we try to find alums who have been, however marginally, involved in the production of insect fear films, or if I can get them, the director of the Bee Movie, the movie with Jerry Seinfeld, feature-length animated film about
like
bees,
that's
coming
new,
out November 2nd. He also worked on Ants, so we may be able to do an all-animated 25th festival. But still, we're trying to see who we can bring in for our special event.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
May Barenbaum is professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois.